No, that's good.
Good?
All right. That was it.
So
over here.
Too much Halloween candy, Gregor. Come on.
I bought $25 worth, and we had two kids. I'm good. I'm good till Christmas. Jed's grandmother was my mother-in-law's best friend, and Jed's father, a retired lawyer, collector, and part-time dealer of some ability, also became my acquaintance through his collecting activities. I'd see him at shows, and we'd have these lovely conversations. And years went on, and then I'd start seeing Jed at shows all up and down the East Coast, and we'd have similarly lovely conversations because his father had injected him with the collecting virus.
What are we collecting here?
You'll see. An episode about which Jed has written a really lovely short memoir. But in my trade over the past 40 years, I've known many collectors, and typically the collection is over here and their real lives are over here. Collections are sort of something that you do like building ship models. You'd repair to your library in your slippers and smoke your pipe, and it would be your relaxation. But Jed is kind of a new species of collector that I'm starting to see a lot more. Jeff Johnson, who was here a couple of years ago, the bibliographer and collector of Olson. And I think this is characterized by, I mean, the old-fashioned collectors were deeply and passionately involved in what they collected, but these new guys are involved in it in an almost autobiographical way, so that they're collecting the textual object, but they're also collecting the adventure of obtaining the collectible object. So it's a sort of meta collection. It's wonderful stuff to me. He's also blogged extensively and wonderfully about all these activities. I find it great reading. I don't know if any of this makes sense to you, but it will after he starts talking. So.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I want to thank everyone.
Hold it. Let me move the microphone.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
Okay.
Good.
Yep. I want to thank everyone for coming tonight. I realize I'm competing with sports history tonight with the World Series, and I'm just going to be talking about literary history, but I appreciate everyone for coming. I want to thank Greg and Garrett today for letting me kind of book geek out with them and talk and have a great great lunch, and then Greg showing me around Dogtown. I want to thank Henry for letting me in the writer's house twice. When he initiated me, you know, let me in the program, and then when I locked myself out, and he let me back in.
Well, Isaac's the one that let you back in.
Yeah.
He had to climb through the window.
And I want to thank Judy for letting me have access to the library whenever I wanted. And as we'll see in my talk, I think open access to libraries is extremely important, and maybe hopefully a wave of the future. I turned 45 on Sunday, which is kind of a time for reflection. And as Greg says, when I kind of wonder what I've been doing with my life, for half my life I've been a serious and kind of book collector. Looking over all the wonderful and talented kind of writers and scholars and artists that have been at the Writer Center, I wonder if I'm the only or the first collector, but I guess Jeff Johnson was another collector that was here. First and foremost, I'm here as a collector of the work of William Burroughs. Now, that might seem strange, but as you may know from your own experience, or as you may know from reading, book collectors are an envious lot, and I, for one, covet my neighbor's books. And so let me confess, I'm completely envious of the Charles Olson Library down on 108 East Main Street, gathered here in my adopted neighborhood of Gloucester. I've been to the special collections room at the University of Buffalo, and I've handled there and looked through the galley proofs for the first edition of Maximus, the 1 through 10, with Olson's hand annotations on it. I've been to, as Greg can attest, book fairs all over the East Coast, and I've seen a lot of Olson rarities. And I can say, though, I've never experienced anything like what I experienced when I spent, you know, 5-6 hours in the library down the street. I came here expecting to sort of get in contact with Charles Olson. And what I really found when I was at the book center, at the writer's library there, that what I got in contact was another obsessive collector. Ralph Maud and what he did has done over there is absolutely amazing. And I had to kind of check myself sometimes in there. And sometimes when I came into the door and looked at these bookshelves, not to kind of steal some books. And I just want to bring one book in particular that I saw within like 15 minutes of walking in the Writer Center. It's the literary magazine for Tufts University from February 1965. And Greg was talking about the autobiographical and kind of what I collect sometimes and make a personal story of it. This is like a perfect example. Olson is in this copy. Is a poem. He has a poem called "You Can't Use Words as Ideas." And what's interesting to me about it is my parents were both at Tufts when this magazine came out, and I called my mother, and she went through. I went through the list of editors and literary staff, and she knew many of the people on the literary staff and remembered them from Tufts. So, and then reading the poem "Wax" by Donald Hall kind of made me think of my father. So that type of personal interrelationship between family and Olson and stuff, this is precisely the type of item you should check to see whether it's here when I leave. Bibliomania can shame the kleptomania kind of at any time, and the truly obsessed, like Ralph Maud and myself, will acquire books by any means necessary. Early on, as I was feeling my way as a Burroughs collector, I kind of wrote myself a piece, Why I Do Not Collect Olson, But You Should. And the real story at the time, besides kind of what I wrote, was that the basic bottom line was the bottom line. Early on, I wanted to collect first editions that were signed by authors, and that was absolutely impossible with Charles Olson. I sent an email to Greg about a week and a half ago, and there was the two limited editions of the first editions of Maximus poems, and they were selling them for $117,000. Now, that was obviously a misprint. It was a computer error. But even so, getting signed first editions of Olson when I was just starting out as a collector was kind of impossible for me on a financial level. But Burroughs and getting Burroughs signatures, particularly of like the Grove books, was definitely doable and something I could do if I set aside my money to do so. But Olson was, and believe me, remains a source of fascination. And I'm interested in Olson and Burroughs for exactly the same reason. By collecting them, you can gather a fairly comprehensive archive of the history of the alternative press in a little magazine in post-World War II literary history. In many cases, they're in the same publications. For example, Black Mountain Review, Culture, and Floating Bear, which are some of the most important magazines that happened in the 60s and 50s. And in many cases, in a literary magazine of that period, the reason the magazine was formed was because of Olson or Burroughs, or the most important person who was in the magazine was Olson or Burroughs. But I often wish that Burroughs would have been published in some of the places that Olson appeared. For example, Burroughs never appeared in Jargon, and he never appeared in Robert Creeley's Divers Press. Now, Burroughs was in Mexico studying the Mayans at the same time that Olson was there in the 50s, and I wish there was a Mayan letters between Burroughs and Olson that was published by Divers Press, which I think that would have been fantastic. And you'll see in my talk this kind of element of fantasy and wishing of certain books and thinking of fantastic literature I think is important. Now, unfortunately, there can only be one object of my obsession. The passionate collector cannot afford to be promiscuous, and afford, I think, is the key word there. Focus, focus, focus is the mantra of any collector worth his or her salt. But sometimes I cannot help myself to kind of like a pinch of Olson. And for example, I couldn't resist buying the first two editions of the Maximus poems as published by Jargon. And I actually sat here kind of early in the morning when I woke up. I sat in that chair over there and I'd read the first 10 poems. And there's something about, I don't know if you can see it, when you spread these pages in the huge format out on your lap, it opens up like a map. And the poems kind of take you places. They take you to Gloucester, or they take you to All Points Interior and beyond. And there's nothing quite like reading these poems in that large format. The size of the margins is as vast and sublime as the whiteness of the whale, and that's full of meaning. And I think we have to kind of remember both of the books at the library at Maud, and any kind of first edition and books you come in contact with, materiality is key to these books and these books as objects. And I think you can get into contact with Olson's conception of space by reading precisely these editions. I take, and this is from Call Me Ishmael, I take space to be the central fact to man born in America, from Folsom Cave to now. I spell it large because it comes large here, large and without mercy. Now, with these jargon editions, I think Olson talks the talk, but Jonathan Williams, the publisher, gives him the space to walk the walk. And I'm going to kind of, before I talk about the William Burroughs Archive, I want to talk about one particular book in my collection that is kind of completely speculative and kind of a fantastic book. The link to Olson may be as ephemeral as cigarette smoke, but is a book that I think would fit in right here at the Maud Olson Library in Gloucester. Years ago, Warren Wigatow gave me three boxes of little magazines from the 50s and 60s and 70s, and he didn't have to offer it twice. It was kind of like when I was offered to give a reading here at the Writers' Center, I jumped at the chance. And getting those boxes, you know, I was like a kid at Halloween, like around right now, kind of like I was when I walked in the Writers' Center. Some of the magazines actually did relate to Burroughs. There was some Big Tables in there and Chicago Reviews, which are some of the earliest magazines that featured Burroughs and got Naked Lunch, his most famous novel, into print. But more often, the books were kind of intellectual and educational for me because they formed the core of a library of someone interested in post-World War II American poetry outside of the tradition of the Beats. So mainly in the tradition of Pound, William Carlos Williams, Louis Tukosky, and Gertrude Stein, as practiced through poets like Robert Duncan, Jack Spicer, and, of course, Charles Olson. So I'm going to focus on one book in particular from that box. And Ian Sinclair, I don't know if you read his book American Smoke, he kind of had a couple paragraphs on this book of mine in that book. And so when Warren showed me the box, he pulled out this worn-out copy of A Controversy of Poets. As you can see, it's a little worse for the wear. It's got insect bites on the top, and then it's got this very conspicuous cigarette stain on the cover. Now, the story, as Warren Wigatow told me, is that the cigarette came from the cigarette of Charles Olson, and it was possibly when Olson kind of launched into one of his all-night conversations where he talked on and touched on everything. Now, Olson, you know, died of cancer in 1970, but I've always associated a cigarette kind of with his vitality. It's as much a part of his myth as his size and the intensity of his eyes. In my view of, like, if I was in an all-night conversation with him, it'd be completely veiled in cigarette smoke. And his hand, as it gestures and pokes and prods like his speech and thoughts, would hold the tail end of a butt. And that image that's iconic for me about Olson is the one that Ann Charters took down at the harbor. That's on the cover of the Maximus poems by the University of California Press, and he's holding a cigarette. Now, as for this, you might cry complete bullshit on the source of the cigarette burn, but I want to ask you to give me the benefit of the doubt, because if you look inside, it's Garrett Lansing's copy. As you all know, Garrett in the 60s edited Set, which was an important magazine, Four Winds, which was on the shelf here at the Writers' Center, that put Gloucester on the map as a polis for publishing poetry. Now, Set was featured in the Bible for my book collecting, which is a secret location on the Lower East Side, which kind of laid out kind of what was the collecting landscape for little magazines in the Mimeo Revolution. The reason this book I kind of fantasize might have been burned by Olson is that at one point Gerard Malenga stayed at Garrett Lansing's house when he interviewed Olson in Gloucester in the late 60s, and that interview appeared in Paris Review after Olson's death. But I'm asking you, is it not too much of a stretch that Lansing or Olson or Malenga brought the anthology to the interview? And then here's the description of what the scene was like where the interview happened. In the kitchen, on the table, with beer cans, cigarette and cigar butts, and unanswered correspondence. So maybe after the talk, we'll have Garrett say what the real story is. But let me have my fantasy just a little bit longer. The book itself kind of tells an interesting story with or without the cigarette stain. Much has been made in academic circles over the politics of anthologies and their role in canon formation. In the mid-50s to the 60s, there were three anthologies in particular that kind of laid out what they thought the gospel of poetry was at the time. The first one was in 1957. That was edited by Robert Pack, Lewis Simpson, and Donald Hall. And they called it the New Poets of England and America. So the placement of England before America kind of shows you where they're coming from. They looked to England for their traditions and placed the future with poets like formalists like Tom Gunn, Ted Hughes, and Philip Larkin. And in America, the lead poet would have been Robert Lowell. And they're following in a tradition of T.S. Eliot, Wallace Stevens, and W.H. Auden. So not surprisingly, Olson doesn't appear in this anthology at all. And the poetics of Pound and Williams, as championed by Olson, found no favor there. Olson's expansive view of form as expressed in projective verse clashed with that closed form poetry in that anthology. Now, in 1960, Donald Allen completely blew that out of the water by emphatically saying there was a new poetry that was firmly rooted in the poetics of Williams and Pound. The next generations of poets wouldn't be from England, but they'd be from Black Mountain, New York, San Francisco, or be found on the road with the Beat Generation. And in that anthology, Olson gets pride of place. He's older than the rest of the poets, but he appears first in the volume, and he dominates the appendix, which is like a whole thing about poetics. Allen believed that the Olson projective verse essay heralded what was new in American poetry, and Olson presides over the anthology like a father figure. And I want to say something about the Maud Olson Library that people don't think about. They always think about the books, but there's this correspondence that Maud did. And, for example, one of the people he corresponds with pretty heavily is Donald Allen. And they kind of, Maud edited the letters between Olson and Allen in the late 50s and early 60s. And you can kind of see kind of how that anthology came together through this correspondence when they're kind of trying to put together an introduction to the volume and stuff. So the correspondence at the library is also very important. Now, A Controversy of Poets, published in 1965, tried to provide like both arguments or both sides of the story in one volume. Paris Leary represents the formalists, and Robert Kelly, who's the editor of Trobar and Matter, which was a really important magazines in the early 60s, and he was then a deep image poet, he edited the New Radicals. Now, Ron Silliman, who was here, he was, a writer in residence here at one point, he wrote in his blog that Robert Kelly redefined in his image just who the New Radicals were. And Garrett Lansing is in this anthology, probably why he owns it. And it once again placed Olson within the kind of poetry. He makes his mark in contemporary poetry. So in one respect, if you want to look at this Cigarettes Burn Kindly, you can say Olson is making his mark on the volume and staking his claim on the poetic community. Yet, if you look at the anthology, which is actually done in alphabetical order, Olson's voice kind of blends in with a chorus of other poets, unlike in the Allen volume, where Olson kind of threatens to drown out all the other poets. The anthology shows that by 1965, Olson has become something of an establishment figure and someone to be reacted against. And I think where this really turning point happens is at the Berkeley Conference in 1965, where Olson kind of declared himself a president of poetry, and he was kind of called a boss poet that had to be kind of overthrown. So poets like Bukowski and the Blue Collar School or Skid Row School, they really felt a poet like Olson or the Beats, needed to be knocked off their pedestal. So something, a volume like this kind of puts Olson back into the fold with the regular poets instead of a leading figure out front. So then in that light, you can view the Cigarette Stain as Olson's act of dismissal or disapproval towards his threatened privileged position in the poetry world. And any anthology that challenges Olson's pride of place was nothing more than an ashtray that Maximus would relegate to the dustbin of literary history. Now, all that's kind of complete playful speculation. But what this, with or without the Cigarette Stain, what this book is has become very special to me because A Controversy of Poets allows me to have a conversation with Olson. Reading about Olson, almost all agree that he was a larger-than-life figure with a superhuman appetite and intellect. This anthology makes me wonder what it would be like to take the full force of Olson for an evening, the cigarettes, the alcohol, and the talk. And we were talking today at lunch how there's absolutely no recording of Charles Olson in conversation. There's talks of him giving interviews or maybe him reading a poetry, but no one's captured what it was like to be at Black Mountain at like 3 in the morning talking to Olson when he's kind of railing on for hours and hours. No one's really captured that Charles Olson. So I wonder kind of what it would be like to take, you know, the force of Olson's talk, how he wielded it with the force of a blunt instrument. The Maximus LP by Folkways, that gives little hint of kind of the strength of his conversation. So the question would be, could I withstand the onslaught? Could I hold my own? And most of all, would I understand what the hell he was talking about? Now, despite all the wonderful Olson books in my library, like this one and these over here, I've placed my faith in Burroughs as a collector. But I should stress that Olson wrote the gospel upon which I've dedicated over 20 years of my life. And the key words for Olson that kind of dictates my collecting comes from a bibliography on America for Ed Dorn. And the quote is, "Best thing to do is to dig one thing, or place, or man, until you yourself know more about that than is possible to any other man. It doesn't matter whether it's barbed wire, or pemmican, or Patterson, or Iowa, but exhaust it, saturate it, beat it." And what I've done in my collecting, I've kind of chosen to beat it, which means I collect William Burroughs from 1953 to 1965. And that's become kind of the barbed wire in which I entangle myself. And that's my Gloucester. And it's also my Iowa, which I should kind of explain. I attended graduate school at the University of Iowa for like about 100 days. And then I dropped out. And it's a wonderful place to learn at Iowa. It was like a great place to kind of get an education. They have the Center of the Book there. They've got Kim Merker, who was with Wendover Press. His press was actually in the English building, and you could go down there anytime you wanted and talk to him about printing for as long as you wanted. It was like a great place to learn about the printing process and the history of printing. And they also had a really great special collection. But at the time I was at Iowa, I realized that I was a scholarly person, and I liked to research, but I was not an academic. This stuff was really important to my life, but it wasn't how I was going to make a living. And I realized that if I wanted the resources at Iowa, which I desperately did, I would have to put them together myself. So dropping out of Iowa drove my collecting into high gear. And I realized, though, taking a cue from Olson, that I couldn't collect everything. So by collecting Burroughs, I could use him and his work as my port of entry into literature, art, and culture of the past, present, and future. And that's what I've done. He's kind of like the microcosm through which I collect everything else. It kind of is filtered through Burroughs. Now, it just so happens that the high point of my Burroughs collection, when it's completed, will be a bibliography. And it's called A Descriptive Catalog of the William S. Burroughs Archive. And I have a kind of a personal myth about Burroughs that I think he really declined and kind of faded as a creative artist when he sold this archive. And he sold it to Roberto Altman in 1973. And the idea was that Burroughs' library and this archive was going to form the basis for an alternative university in Liechtenstein, of all places, kind of like a European Black Mountain College. And that library was going to form the research basis and the foundation for kind of all the academic research they were going to do there. Of course, the school never happened. He bought the collection. Burroughs was motivated to sell the archive so he could leave London and return to the United States after years in exile. And as part of the prospectus to kind of sell this archive to people, they created a book version of what was in the archive. Now, I don't own that book, but what it's like kind of is like this massive volume for the curriculum of the soul that was done in a limited special edition. And the edition of the descriptive archive is a completely lavish edition. It's hardcover. It's got signed versions and numbered copies. Certain copies have manuscript pages in it, and it's become quite a collectible item as an object. But what's really interesting is the contents of the archive. So the book describes the collection of Burroughs' literary manuscripts, his correspondence, his scrapbooks, and his collages. It also describes what Burroughs' library was at that point. And so it kind of gives a sense of what Burroughs' creative achievement was up until that point. And almost all the material in this archive remains unpublished this day. Now, the serpent kind of in this literary paradise of kind of Burroughs' library was Byron Geisen, who was an artist that was associated with Burroughs and was his friend and collaborator. Geisen rediscovered the cut-up technique, which was kind of what Burroughs used throughout the 60s to write. He would kind of take other people's writing or his own writing and kind of cut it together or fold it together, kind of creating new sentences and new phrases, and then he would edit those together to form kind of new texts. The archive really kind of in-depth kind of captures what Burroughs was doing in that period. Now, Geisen came up with the idea of gathering the archive for sale. Now, Burroughs is not free from guilt because he fell victim to Geisen's temptation. I'm using kind of charged terms like fall and guilt because I really believe that when Burroughs sold the archive, he mortgaged his creative capital. And when you think about it, when people talk about the Maude Olson Library, they talk about capturing Olson's mind and soul or getting inside his brain. And Burroughs, when he sold the archive, kind of sold the source of his knowledge and power. The archive serves as a repository for memory, which was crucial to Burroughs' complex handling of nostalgia. Separated from his word hoard, Burroughs suffered from creative amnesia. And after the sale, in my opinion, he was never the same artist again. Now, that's completely debatable. There's other people that say the late Burroughs trilogy, like City of the Red Knight or Place of the Dead Rose or Westernlands, are some of the best things he ever did. I don't particularly believe that. But what is not open for debate is that the sale of the archive set back Burroughs' scholarship almost 30 years. The critical reception of Burroughs is still trying to catch up or even get fully started. Again, this can be blamed on Geisen. The original plan was to sell the archive to Columbia University, which makes a ton of sense because Columbia is where Kerouac and Burroughs and Ginsberg, they all met and got to know each other. And Columbia had some Beat holdings in their archive. So they were really kind of incentivized to have a Burroughs and Beat Studies program. But Geisen basically mucked it up by helping to orchestrate a quick cash sale to Altman. Altman had cash on hand, so they went for that sale instead. And the Vaduz material, which is kind of what the Burroughs archive became called, because it was sold in Vaduz Liechtenstein. It remained in its original packaging after Altman bought it. So no one saw it, no one touched it. And then Altman sold it to another private collector named Robert Jackson. Again, Robert Jackson never opened the stuff in the archive. So for 20, 30 years, nobody really saw what was in this archive. Eventually, it was liberated when it was sold to the New York Public Library in 2006. But even at the New York Public Library, the archive is far from free because of academic and archive protocols. For example, you can only order one item at a time. So if you want to compare different manuscripts or different versions of text, you have to do it individually. You can't put them side by side. You can't take images. You can't take photographs. Now, it's completely understandable in some ways because of institutional protocols, but it's very unfortunate. Now, Burroughs studies, because of this, are likewise imprisoned in abstractions and theory, with the notable exception of Burroughs scholar Oliver Harris and certain other graduate students. There's been an attempt to break themselves and Burroughs free by locking themselves in the archive. So I think that bibliography is crucial to the future of Burroughs studies, and it's the work of scholars of the book like Robert Darton, D.F. McKenzie, and Jerome McGann that suggest a sociology of Burroughs needs to be fully developed. So what we need is like an exploration of the history of Burroughs books, and that's kind of being done. When you compare different versions of manuscripts and different editions, and you see how the book was put together and how the book was kind of created by Burroughs, and that work is kind of being done. What also needs to be done is examining Burroughs' communication network, involving Burroughs as an author, his publishers, his booksellers, the printers, the readers, and the collectors, and seeing how this network and nexus kind of works together. We can then use enumerative, descriptive, textual, and analytic bibliography as a way to study Burroughs. And then Charles Olson, the scholar, and Olson's scholarships are like an excellent model for Burroughs studies. Olson, as a young man, reconstructed Herman Melville's library and studied Melville's annotations, such as King Lear. This bibliographic research formed the foundations for Call Me Ishmael, and the late Maximus poems, and many of the Maximus poems, are really kind of Burroughs writing his annotations and marginalia into poems. As for Olson Scholarship, I think kind of what we can use in Burroughs Scholarship is something like Olson, which is the journal of the University of Connecticut Archives. And this issue, which is just issue number 5, what they've done is they've taken notebooks of Olson, projected poems, outlines of poems, notes, basically manuscript material, and they've made it publicly available to people in a chapbook. With modern technology, I kind of think the same thing should be done with libraries by making stuff electronically available with scans, and then having, let's say, a graduate student kind of write it up or kind of make an analysis of the material. The graduate student would definitely jump at the chance. And then for like a Burroughs fan like me, it'd be like book porn, kind of like seeing these kind of manuscripts and everything online. And then I think possibly this is the direction that things are going, and it could be a development. And I would not be surprised if it is, because there's a revolution going on in libraries and archives. At the University of Florida State University, they're using a Burroughs archive to kind of build a digital database, and then using like HTML markups and various kind of searching capabilities and comparison, like red lines. They're using that so the electronic material can be used kind of creatively and manipulated in different manners through the kind of digital material. My site, Reality Studio, provides an archive with no institutional ties and no protocols, built from private holdings. So I have different letters from like Carl Weissner or Jan Herman, these people that edited or kind of corresponded with Burroughs, and I've made relationships with them. So I've put their stuff through scanning and made it online. Or different magazines I've scanned and made them available online as well. The Olson Library here in Gloucester provides a middle road, with the local community playing an important role in maintaining libraries, archives, and research centers. So what we can do now is, between the three different levels, institutional, community, and individual, we can have ties between them, and we could all learn a few things from the Mimeo Revolution, such as the encouragement of the do-it-yourself spirit with open access and open distribution. And I think kind of what I had with Judy was like, I think that spirit is kind of available here in Gloucester. Now, as Burroughs fans, we have Michael Stevens' Road to Interzone, which is a book that documents Olson's reading in his library. But I think Ralph Maud, who wrote a similar book on Olson called Olson's Reading, he went a little bit further, and he took the bibliographic and made it biographic. And he kind of documents Olson's whole life through the books he read and you know, through the books that he experienced. I think something like that would be really exciting for Burroughs studies. And then Maud kind of went even further as like recreating physically the Olson Library. And that library is here in Gloucester for the asking. So until Burroughs' archive, his library, and his bibliography are more fully accessible, accessed, and documented, Burroughs studies are kind of like a fraud. And I'm kind of using criminal terms because Olson started as a writer by his own admission. If you read the book Queer, he says he started as a writer with the shooting of his common-law wife, Joan Vollmer. He had to kind of write his way out of guilt and get out from the evil, ugly spirits, as he called it. I personally think he kind of declined and his writing ended with a betrayal, which is the sale of the archive, which put his mind and soul back into the control, you know, in the control of the evil, ugly spirits. And by ugly spirits, I mean the agents of bureaucratic and institutional control, which are agents of evil in the Burroughsian universe. So nothing like the Olson Library here in Gloucester exists for Burroughs. There's no collection of Burroughs' annotations, let alone a full-scale reconstruction of his library. And I wish that Burroughs had such a space. I, for one, envy Burroughs Olson's reading and his annotations. And we could maybe discuss afterwards kind of the difference between Olson and Burroughs' readers and their different libraries. From my experience, Burroughs was not an annotator. He wrote from the margins, but not in the margins. For those obsessed with Burroughs, you have to become Borgesian to experience some such books. You have to envision not a library of Babel exactly, but what I call a library of interzone, after the hallucinated borderlands of Naked Lunch. So if you want annotated books for Burroughs, you have to make them up. You kind of have to dream them and kind of make your own library. And I have one of those books, but should we go to question and answer, or what should we do? I can read an example, or we can go on. Okay. So this is a book I completely made up, and kind of fantasizing what it would mean for Olson's, for Burroughs's annotations. So the book I picked is one of my favorites, which is The Soft Machine, which was published by Olympia Press in 1961. So first we have kind of the description of what the book is. So this is William Burroughs's personal copy, annotated in 1964 and 1965. The notations are in Burroughs's characteristic tight script, proper and reserved. The color scheme of the novel has not been repeated in the notations, which are in uniform black pen of an unvarying shade. Apparently the same pen was used for all notations, which suggests uniformity. Magic marker might have been used on the galleys in later edits, but not this initial attempt at editing. The dust jacket is carefully folded and tipped into the front cover. The condition of the book, particularly the wrappers, is near mint, which is surprising given Burroughs' constant movement in the mid-60s. The book presents a dignified, business-like appearance. Although the green cover stands out in a bookshelf, this is not the result of a flamboyant jacket, but is conspicuous in the manner of a finely tailored monochrome suit, much like Burroughs wore. So this is kind of the description of the book. And then what I did was I kind of, what does that book mean? What can you gather from that book? So the kind of descriptive bibliography part is, I'll be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. Annotating a book is a form of reflection. To annotate your own writing is to stare into a mirror. While Burroughs wrote at the Beat Hotel what would become the Olympia Press edition of Soft Machine, he and Byron Geisen experimented with scrying, gazing into a mirror in order to get into one's head and look into one's soul. According to Ted Morgan's biography of Burroughs, Literary Outlaw, quote, when Burroughs tried mirror gazing, he saw his hands in the mirror, with the fingers amputated, looking completely inhuman, pink, black, and fibrous, with long white tendrils growing where the fingers should have been. And then Morgan adds, Burroughs wasn't sure what was going on, but the paranormal phenomena were flying thick and fast. He felt that he had crossed an important barrier, and he was in a very dangerous place. There was no going back. And the Olympia Press edition of Soft Machine crosses the important barrier of turning prose into poetry. Commercially, this is a very dangerous place. The book was and is a desert island classic, a book to jump into and get lost in, difficult, cryptic, and obscure. And if you haven't read the Olympia Press edition of The Soft Machine, it's almost like a French prose poem. It's kind of like poetry in like the Rimbaud-type tradition put into a novel format. Now, in the mid-60s, Burroughs rewrote The Soft Machine for publication by Grove Press, and then he rewrote it again for publication by John Calder in Great Britain. So I guess that few people would have read the Soft Machine version from Olympia Press. The only way you can get it is to buy it on the rare book market. So Burroughs' near-mint copy of the Olympia Press Soft Machine with its crisp green wrappers demonstrates Burroughs preparing himself for public display. The black-pink fibrous authorial hand of the Olympia Press Soft Machine had to be manicured. Burroughs writes in December 23, 1966, in a letter to Geisen, I dare say many phosphorescence and iridescence fell to my magic marker, and maybe the better word would be amputated. This is Burroughs again about the editing process. I went through the original edition and used all the material that was anyway usable, and the material I added was grafted on with some care. A little scar tissue is unavoidable in such cases. So the Grove Press Soft Machine, it's not blissfully experimental like the Olympia Press Soft Machine with its elaborate color schemes and the musket poetry. Burroughs' annotations are tight, legible, and compact, unlike the fevered holograph appearing in the Lost Notebook from Peru, edited by Oliver Harris. And Burroughs kept notebooks when he made his travels, and he was traveling down to Central and South America to find hallucinogenic vines. And the kind of writing there was kind of a fever, you know, the writing was all over the place and kind of like a derangement of the senses. Yet like the notebook, the Olympia Soft Machine bears the print of Burroughs' amputated finger. As a young man, Burroughs, in an act of devotion, cut off his little finger with poultry shears to make an impression on a love interest, a Van Gogh kick, as he called it. This is the Burroughs of passion, desire, and obsession. This is the Burroughs of poetry. And to prevail in the court of public opinion, this evidence must be destroyed. And this is Burroughs' verdict of kind of the new edition. Everyone I've talked to has read this Olympia Soft Machine, and the revised edition says they find the revised edition much more readable. The Grove Press soft machine is all business. The wild poetics of the original version have been trimmed, tightened, placed in the gray flannel suit of narrative. Burroughs' annotated Olympia edition reveals the grooming process. This is a controlled Burroughs, taming an unruly poetics. The edits are surgical and precise. The deletions are struck through with a steady hand, seemingly with a ruler. There is no evidence of doubt or regret. Burroughs is homo economus. The annotations are as cold and rational as the philosophies of Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill. They were written by the invisible hand, thus erasing the mark of the long white tendrils of poetry. That's all complete fantasy on my part. I made it up. But for people that are interested in Olson and Olson annotations, they don't have to make it up. It's right down the street for people. And those books they live on here in Gloucester, and they bring Olson to life. And for the past few days, such are the books I've been touched by. And I can't thank everyone enough for the experience. It's been a dream come true to share in such fantastic literature. Thanks.
Have you listened to the NET stuff with Olson carrying forth?
No.
It's like this guy came to Gloucester.
Okay.
And, Gary, do you remember like 64 maybe? I forget his name.
Richard Moore. Yeah.
Oh, we talked about that a little bit at lunch today.
Yeah. He shot a lot of.
Oh, he captures that?
Yeah, so he does.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check it out.
You should check it out.
Yeah.
At one point, we may have that on the Ralph Maud website, but
right.
We need to get a few more grants in order to digitize it.
Right.
Is it but film, Henry?
Yeah,
or
it's film.
Audio?
It's film. Wow. And it's available at San Francisco State.
Oh, okay.
Out there. But, there's some great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I think
Michael Franco also had a copy of that, which he showed in Cambridge afterwards, too, and got it from San Francisco.
Yeah.
So he probably still may have
it. No, I have it, too. I got them all when I went out there.
So what I have to know is, what's the cigarette stain? Is it Olson?
I think it is.
You
I'll
do?
I have to ask Warren.
Warren told me. I'm not sure where he got the story from.
Yeah.
So.
Well, when I knew Warren, of course, was in Washington and Annapolis.
Right.
Down there. Because I have other copies of that.
Uh-huh.
And I presume I gave that. I don't have the memory of how
right.
I got my copy.
Right.
Because I have other copies of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's always been like a really just, thinking and kind of fantasizing about the how it all happened is kind of interesting.
But the two editors were totally at odds.
Right.
Speaking. Paris Leary was very, very conventional.
Right.
And Kelly was much more exploratory.
Right.
In that sense, yeah. But I wanted to ask you, what do you think in the Burroughs archive of Burroughs' art, of shooting at the drip paintings, which you did in Kansas?
That's later. So the initial archive would have art in a different way, which is what the art that I think Burroughs is doing, and the art that I find more interesting is when he was doing scrapbooks and kind of like collages with cut-ups. So he'd take pages of like three columns of text and then put like magazine pictures and then do kind of some work on drawings and create these elaborate scrapbooks and collages using text and image. Those are definitely represented in the archive, as I'm describing it with the 73 archive. I'm not sure there's as much of the later art, which he kind of did painting in Lawrence.
He is cut from the archive.
Well, I mean, it would definitely not have been in that initial archive that was sold in 1973. No. There might be some examples of that at the New York Public Library, but I think a lot of that stuff is kind of floating around in other places or maybe even still be in private hands.
Yeah. Well, was James Grauerholtz the executor for Burroughs, who would be in charge of...
He's still in charge of the Burroughs estate.
So the art part would be still in his...
He might have a fair amount of it, with the estate. I know, I remember being in London going a student abroad, and I went to a show in London where they were selling the Seven Deadly Sins series. So a lot of that stuff was up for market in galleries and for sale. So private hands might be some of that stuff that was the artwork at that point.
I think there's still some of it on the market.
I think there is. I think you're right. Yeah. So I don't know how much of it has been kind of like art. You know, people have done definitely gallery shows, and I think it's more in the gallery system rather than in the library system. Yeah.
You said that you couldn't take more than one book or something at the library.
Oh, at the New York Public Library, my understanding is you take one folder at a time.
Can't you take several and stay in the library?
No. My understanding, my understanding is how it works is you fill out a slip, you get one item at a time, you hand that item back, and you get another item.
Even if you don't take them out?
Right. Say you're in a special room. Oh. That room actually has cameras in it, and you... you get one item at a time. Now, you go to the library down the street, you can take as many books at a time as you want. It's a much more freer, not as much as so institutionalized here as my experience here so far.
But
it's
you, much, stay, you can't stay in the library with more than one.
No.
Inside.
So in the room, you get one item at a time.
I think that may be true in stores, too.
It might be.
It's certainly true in the Warburg Institute.
Right.
And other archival places. They're very, very careful.
Right. Now, what's different, a little bit different about the New York Public Library, some places you can take scans and photographs. They're really restrictive on the scans and photographs at the New York Public Library.
But that might limit the research.
Of course, exactly.
It's terrible.
I know, yeah. It's a really tough atmosphere to kind of get a lot of comparative scholarship, you know, with between text and manuscripts together. It's not the most free and easy process. In some universities, you know, it kind of varies in different places, but the New York Public Library is pretty restrictive.
Do you know if the Buffalo archives would be the same way?
No, I've had a great experience at Buffalo. Yeah. I mean, I've been, you know, I've dealt a lot with the magazines there. You know, I've gone there and said, I want these seven magazines at one time, and they'll bring them out all at once. I found Buffalo to be great, you know. And they're just for the, I know Jim Maynard there. He's the assistant librarian. He's really helpful. And Baczynski is great too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So where does all this go? You collect everything that you can collect up to your financial means, and then what happens?
Well, I mean, at a certain point, I guess you gotta disperse it, right? I mean, yeah, at a certain, you know, you say when I'm done, like when I'm finished collecting?
No, because I don't think you'll ever be finished collecting, but at some point you'll reach the sort of material limit, but you'll still be on that trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, the Burroughs stuff, it constantly expands. Recent example, I just went to a book show and I talked to you, right? And I was like, I'm done. I'm not finding anything I want. And at that book show, they had a complete run of John Wiener's Measure, which is done out of Boston. And they also had a poster for a reading they did to finance more issue, you know, the third issue of Measure. And then he had that poster and the three books. Oh, and then he also had something else too. And what I found out was that Burroughs was not in that magazine, but there was a story behind why Burroughs wasn't in that magazine, and that became interesting for me. Like, Wiener's had access to Burroughs' manuscripts but chose not to publish them. So the story became then for me, why didn't he appear in this magazine? That made total sense for him to appear.
So my question is it possible for this material collection to spread out into a collection of greater stories of things,
sure,
that people said about,
yeah,
things?
Yeah, yeah. I think it just kind of grows out where you kind of, you know, make connections. I got a complete run of Set because I think that fits in with, you know, the magazines that are related to it, and it kind of grows in that kind of way, you know. I mean, the amount of magazines that Burroughs was actually in from 1957 to 1965 that I actually need, there's not a ton of them. But
so you could have a financial or material limit, but that's not really a limit at all, is it?
Yeah, it just keeps, because I get other interests and stuff. Yeah. Or at least it's been that's been the way for 22 years. And I've been writing about it fairly consistently for the last 10, so.
Wasn't there an attempt to do a better edition of Naked Lunch than the first American?
Well, they've, what they did was they did a restored text.
Yeah,
okay, so that's been done. Now there's some, so that was done by Barry Miles and Grauerholtz. Oliver Harris has done other editions. He did editions of Junkie and Queer, for example. He did the Cut Up trilogies, and that type of research where you went into the archives and married all the different manuscripts and texts. That wasn't exactly, I think, what was done with the restored text. So there is an option or a possibility that Naked Lunch will be done again, but I'm not sure that Oliver Harris is going to kind of take on that project. But there was, you're right, there was a restored edition of Naked Lunch that was done. So now the book that you're buying in the bookstore, you're no longer buying the edition that was done in 1962 when Naked Lunch came out for the American public, the Grove edition, which was somewhat a little bit different from the version that was done in Paris in 1959, the Olympia edition. So with Burroughs' whole bibliography, all the editions are different. There's textual changes in all of them. So to kind of say there's like one soft machine, it's not true. There's at least three editions. And then Oliver Harris just put out another edition. So there's all these kind of textual fluidity with Burroughs. And that's why the archives are so important, because, the manuscripts and the different versions, and then the magazines become important because the magazines had little versions of these magazines as well. So the whole thing kind of forms this, what's a word hoard, which is kind of what Burroughs was working with.
I'd always wondered if he was much influenced by Finnegan's Wake when it came out, because I feel there's a relation between the creation of Finnegan's Wake and the cut-up.
There is an element of that, like experimental novel, with Naked Lunch, and particularly the first soft machine. He definitely knew Joyce, from a Harvard education, he knew all about the classics.
And he certainly knew Tristan Tzara too, who did the first conceptual idea of cut-ups.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you talk about Olson's library versus Burroughs' library. Burroughs read a lot of junk, like what would be considered junk. I mean, like westerns and science fiction, books on UFOs. He got into a lot of kind of conspiracy theory type stuff. So his library has a lot of stuff that you just don't see in Olson. You don't see any like fun stuff in Olson's library. It's like there's like literary magazines and there's scholarly articles and stuff, but there's no like westerns or science fiction.
No, there's like Charlie's comic books in there.
There's not many. It's few and far between. Burroughs is all over the place. I mean, and Burroughs then used that, like his late novels, takes the Western genre, and he writes a book using Western themes. And, in the 60s, he's writing kind of science fiction novels with the cut-ups.
What about detective stuff? That voice is in there somewhere.
Yeah, he's got a lot of noir elements. Yeah, Clem Snide was kind of a character. It was kind of like a noir character. He's got that element. I mean, Junkie is kind of like a hard-boiled, his first novel.
Yeah, sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like a drugstore paperback type thing. That's how it was published. So,
how could he keep the library together when he was moving so
sure,
much?
Sure, right.
From all over the
place. It's amazing that the archive was as extensive as it was. I mean, there's just tons. There was a legendary suitcase of Burroughs' stuff that disappeared called the Hardiman suitcase, because this guy Melville Hardiman had it. And it eventually got, that was supposed to be kind of like Hemingway's suitcase, right? That legendary suitcase that had all the manuscripts and all the stuff in it. And people there's been Jim Pennington, who's a publisher of Allo's books out in England. He basically has done some great stuff about tracking down where the suitcase went and Burroughs' kind of relationship with Melville Hardiman and stuff. So, and he printed that as like a little thing that his press did. It's like, it's not a formal book or anything. It's kind of interesting how he presented his argument in kind of like a limited edition type, almost mimeo-ish type thing. So it's kind of cool.
You should write up that suitcase.
You should write the contents of that suitcase.
Yeah.
Get an old suitcase and put it in it.
But it recreate the suitcase, kind of like a Duchamp type thing.
Yeah, I think you can spend the next 20 years doing that.
Yeah. Well, that would fit in with the fantastic literature thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You make your own mark, see?
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about your website and all that internet-based activity that is the way in which you...
Sure.
Gathering and publishing.
Yeah. Reality Studio started in like 2005, and it was like kind of like a fan site. You know, it was like a William Burroughs appreciation site. And then I got in contact with him in like March of 2006, just kind of as a fan, saying, hey, this is a great website. And I sent him like an early kind of thing I kind of did my own on the internet. I kind of worked my own hypertext, you know, kind of did it myself. And I'd written a couple articles, including that article, Why Did I Click Olson, But You Should. And he looked at that and said, do you want to do a column for the website? And eventually what I'd said I decided to do is just document my book collection on it and just kind of explore what I owned. And I just had a lot more to say than I initially thought. It just kind of kept going, and then that became like scanning covers and scanning art, you know, like appearances at Burroughs, and then eventually got into like scanning entire magazines. So like my own mag, which is the most important magazine that Burroughs ever worked with, we got a complete scans of every page of every issue and posted that online. And same with Ed Sanders, Fuck You, a magazine of the arts. We've got every issue of every page, you know, of every page on that. So it became like an archive. It became a resource. And I actually have people, you know, Oliver Harris, when he was doing his recent cut-up trilogy, he would contact me, say, could you have this magazine? Can you scan this or take a photograph of it? Instead of, you know, finding it in a library and going through a library, he kind of went through me. So it's become kind of a research archive, and particularly for the images and stuff like that, people definitely use them.
Is there any pushback from the estate?
We are definitely in contact with the estate.
So they're cool with
it? Yeah, definitely. I mean, if there's anything like really crazy, like really, you know, that would be really hot, you know, like on a publishing level, we tell them about it. You know, but like a lot of this stuff, it's kind of like a very small, minuscule audience. Or academic audience.
How many Fuck Yous did Ed do?
He did 4 in the initial run and then did 7 after that. So there's 13 or 4. And I think it's 13 issues. And then he did 9. So the numbering system's weird. It goes volume 1, volume 2, volume 3, volume 4. Then he does the volume 5, issue 1, volume, and it goes on for another 9 issues. So it's 13 issues. Yeah. And then he actually... The Ed Sanders archive is up for sale right now. Mm-hmm. Steve Clay is selling it. And in that archive, there's a last issue that Ed Sanders put together. And he still has the Mimeo stencils of it. Like, he could run it off a Mimeo machine right now. And that's the type of stuff that's in that Sanders archive. It's absolutely amazing. Boo Hooray Gallery did a show of Sanders where he pulled stuff out of this archive. It's amazing kind of what's in there. Documenting that kind of yippie, hippie, kind of underground, you know, the thug stuff. Mm-hmm.
It's huge, too, right?
It's mad. I mean, he really understood how he's a historian. I mean, he kind of learned from Olson about history and kind of documenting your own existence and your own life. And Sanders really documented and kept everything. So that archive is pretty extensive. Like, he kept handbills for readings, you know, all that type of stuff.
Is that quote that fictional thing that you wrote based on the, you know, Burroughs not having any notes? Mm-hmm. The quotes in there, are those?
Those are from his letters.
Those are from his letters.
No, those are actual. I didn't make that stuff up. Actually, so what I did was I kind of created this Library of Interzone, and I did. I think I wrote 7 of them up. So it would be like Philip K. Dick editing a Blade Runner. Burroughs wrote a book called Blade Runner that they took the name to make the Philip K. Dick film. I did one of Norman Mailer kind of annotating Western lands, stuff like that. And in that, I threw in one which was Oliver Harris's annotations to Naked Lunch, which actually exists, and we provided scans of it. So there's like kind of like a Trojan horse in there. So if you think it doesn't exist, well, here's one that does, so you don't know which ones are real and which ones aren't. But we kind of played around with it. And I made call numbers for them all. It's all really silly. It's kind of,
yeah. Do you track on your website where the hits are coming from?
I don't know if we track where they're coming. I don't. That's the thing. So basically how the site works is the guy that does all the technical stuff, and he does some a little bit of writing here and there, but he really puts the site together. And it's really kind of do-it-yourself. Like, he rents his own server space and, you know, all that type of stuff. He kind of codes it all and does it all the stuff himself. He has programs where you can tell how many hits we have, you know, and track that type of stuff. I don't know if you can track where they're coming from, but he definitely gets information about what's going on with the content of this, you know, the traffic of the site and stuff.
Do you have a contact information on it? I mean, do people email you?
Sure. Yeah. He gets emails. He gets emails directly to him, and then, you know, some people find out my email and contact me. But, you know, you can email the Reality Studio site, and then if it's something that's relevant to me, it'll be forwarded to me. I've got...
Because you never know who's lurking out there, you know, some genius out in the woods.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I the requests I get, like, for one of the more interesting stories was I put the photographs for Culture, which is an important magazine in the 60s, and the second issue has a picture of Bob Thompson, the painter, on the cover. And there's a lot of interest right now with Bob Thompson, who an African-American painter who died young of a heroin overdose in the 60s. And a lot of people, I mean, I got a fair amount of contact, like, who took that picture? What's the story behind the kind of photographic session with Bob Thompson? Because he wasn't photographed very often. And he was photographed actually in his studio, which is very unusual. So people contacted me a lot about that particular photograph, which was done by a guy named Charles Rottmill, who lives up in Maine. And then Charles, I decided, well, I should interview Charles. So I interviewed him. And then Charles said, well, I got more stories to tell. And can I use you as a way to do my memoirs? And so I just started posting all this stuff that Charles wrote. It has nothing to do with Burroughs, but it's just interesting. And, you know, he kind of, you know, he talks about going up to see Henry Miller and traveling around to Mexico in the 50s. And, you know, he was at the various places and he knew Diane Arbus and, you know, all this type of interesting stuff. So that all kind of grew out of just a request that people were making for stuff. And then Charles himself emailed and said, hey, where can I get a copy of Culture 2? I don't have one, that type of stuff. It happens, you know, maybe a couple times a month. Yeah.
Just a huge connector.
Sure. I mean, I just got an email yesterday from a guy that's wanting to put together a book. The Oxford University Press did a bunch of books on the modernist magazines. He wants to do one now on the 60s magazines. And he was like, what ideas do you have? And that's all based on the Reality Studio of Mimeo Mimeo stuff.
So. Do you have the films that Burroughs did with Anthony Balch? Or
a lot of that, all that stuff, I believe, is available on a site called Ubu Web.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and I believe all those films are on that site.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that's, I'm almost certain. At least a couple of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, something like that, you know, I didn't really, you know, I don't know if we'd really do that because it didn't come out of my collection. I mean, most of the stuff on the Reality Studio site came from my collection or from contacts that we made because of the stuff we had on this, like someone sending us stuff because of that. You know, something like those movies, which you can't really acquire as an object or something like that, and I'm not sure we'd really post that.
Because I know Jeff Johnson was having, with the Ian Sinclair, mm-hmm. back for a lot of things because of all of Sinclair's movies mm-hmm. and interviews and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we have one movie that Jan Herman, who was an editor, he did a magazine called San Francisco Earthquake. And he went to England to visit Burroughs in 1971 and took an early, really early form of like a video camera. you know, like a VHS camera. And he did like experiments with Burroughs with this video camera. And he found the tape, he found it, and he got it kind of redigitized with a newer form of, you know, technology. And we posted that. And it's pretty bad quality, but it just shows like an early video experiment that was done with Burroughs. So like that type of thing we'd be, you know, really excited to put up. You
it's
know.
Astounding what's saved, what people say.
Sure. I mean,
it just boggles my mind. It's stuff that's out there that's still in attics and cellars and places.
Well, that thing I was telling you about the Hardiman suitcase, that guy, Jim Pennington, he went and kind of went on a little down a wormhole to figure out what was going on. And he found the woman named Harriet Crowder who took the photographs. So if you know the Burroughs LP, the Call Me Burroughs, the really famous picture of Burroughs, she took that picture back in 1960 around the time of the suitcase and everything. So he found her, and she had like three other photographs that were taken that day that no one had ever seen. So he did like a really small gallery, pop-up gallery show in England about these photographs, and then wrote up a little thing. And that kind of scholarship is kind of interesting. That's the type of stuff that we really think is kind of cool.
Did Burroughs work on dream machines with Geisinger?
Sure, of course, yeah.
So that those count as Burroughs as well as Geisinger?
Sure, they thought, it's kind of funny, they thought that was going to be a huge moneymaker. Like, they thought that was going to make them rich. I mean, and it's not that far-fetched when you think about what was going on in the early 60s with, like, assemblage art and kind of that type of optic type thing was kind of big in the early 60s. It was selling in the art market. It just, for whatever reason, they never hit it. They could never, you know, it's kind of weird. Burroughs always wanted to sell out. But he was never in step with, you know, he just always, what he thought was a sellable product was like the worst thing, worst experimental thing in the world, you know. It was just kind of, I mean, you know, he was trying to write a novel that everyone would read and would be about with Naked Lunch, and that was like the most accessible stuff he could write, you know. So, yeah.
He made a lot of records, too.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, with John Giorno, the whole Dial of Poets records. And then other artists started collaborating with him a bunch, particularly as he got older. He did some hip-hop records at one point. I think he did some stuff with Ministry, and there's, a lot of stuff. Yeah. Or Ministry used him in videos and stuff. I mean,
he was a weird figure by
then. Yeah, and then like, you know, Genesis Peorage of Throbbing Gristle kind of was influenced. Industrial music was very much influenced. Sampling would have been influenced by Burroughs. Yeah. Burroughs was doing a lot of sound experiments in the 60s. He had access to, people don't know that there was a label with Apple Records, the Beatles Apple Records called Zapple, which was going to be like an experimental record label where they were going to do...
On it too.
Huh?
Olson was going to be on
Zapple. And it was going to be like a spoken word kind of experimental. And a couple records did appear on Zapple. I think a Yoko Ono record appeared on Zapple. But they got rid of it when they kind of... Alan Klein came in and they redesigned the Beatles financially. But the kind of studio engineer for Zapple was Ian Somerville, who was Burroughs' lover. And he had kind of access to the studio. So he and Burroughs would go in there with this high-end studio and do all these sound and tape experiments. And those tape experiments are available in a CD called Real Tea Made Here. And they're kind of it's like sound collages. And they're really interesting. Not at all what you think of kind of like Burroughs as a writer, but he did film, as people mentioned. He did sound kind of tape experiments. He even did some, I wrote a thing about Burroughs, Bukowski, and the computer, where I thought like it was weird that Bukowski used a computer, but an experimental writer like Burroughs never used a computer. He just didn't kind of expand into that way. And I figured it was because he was old and he was more of a hands-on kind of gesturing type person. And some guy corrected me. He wrote me and said he did a computer experiment with Burroughs. And then he sent us a little article about this kind of computer, you know, manipulations that Burroughs was involved in with him. So you kind of learn stuff all the time.
Did Burroughs and Olson ever, like, connect?
I don't really know that I mean, they may have brushed shoulders or something. What we were thinking was maybe in London, because Burroughs and
Grady,
yeah, Burroughs and Olson were in London at the same time.
Yeah.
But I don't really think so. There's no Burroughs in the Olson Library.
Really?
No, there's the closest thing is this thing called Fuzz Against Junk, which was written by Akbar Del Piombo, which is a pseudonym for Norm Rubinstein.
Yeah.
It's like a collage novel involving kind of drugs. And a lot of people thought that Burroughs wrote it, but he didn't. It was someone else. And it was done by Olympia Press around the same time as Naked Lunch. If you read Olson's reading, there's a couple mentions of Burroughs. In the New American Story anthology with Robert Creeley, he mentions that he was really impressed by Burroughs' story, like Burroughs' writing in there. And then also Olson kind of admitted he didn't think it was cool enough to read Burroughs. So he was kind of intimidated.
You know how Barry Miles got like hooked up with Olson?
Yeah. Well, Barry Miles was hooked up with the book scene in England. So he ran Better Books in Indica. And he was kind of like the book dealer for a lot of these guys. He like kind of got all the little mags together. He ran a shop. He ran his own little mag. He ran International Times, the underground paper. He was connected to Paul McCartney. He was connected to John Hopkins, Hoppy Hopkins. So he had a lot of connections with the counterculture. And then he went, and you know, when they decided that they were going to record, they wanted to do like Richard Brautigan, Bukowski, Olson, and there's a list of kind of people they wanted to record. And some of the recordings, like that Folkways recording, you know, that they came out on a different label. You know, the Richard Brautigan didn't come out on Zappel, it came out on a different label. But the recordings were done. It just didn't come out the way they anticipated.
Are they available at the somewhere?
If you go to, like, you know, Mystery Train and find one for, like, $35, you know. They may be reissued on CD. I'm not really sure. I mean, I have some of the vinyl. That's pretty cool.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
When do you go back to Baltimore?
I'm going to go up to Maine for a couple days and then I go back Monday.
Where do you go up there?
Outside of Ellsworth.
Oh,